Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is America a country of intelligent free thinkers, or have we become instead a nation of mindless automatons who place more credence in gut feeling than intelligent thought and scientific rigor? My guest today will argue that for all its influence on 21st century civil discourse, the gut is a moron. And he worries that what he calls the war on expertise leaves our entire society vulnerable to the whims of ill-informed public opinion over hard fact and objective reality. You've probably heard writer Charles P. Pierce in one of his many appearances on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. His latest book is called Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. It's just been released in tradeback with a new afterword. Charlie, welcome to Think.
Hey, it's nice to be here.
Is there a difference between willful ignorance and stupidity?
I think that the latter can be healed. The latter can be recovered from. The former can't.
Mm-hmm.
The former is, as the adjective implies, a willed behavior.
You know, what tends to surprise me is that some of the people who tend to shout the loudest about their distrust for science and intellectualism are people in politics and the media, most of whom have had at least a university-level education, very often at a pretty prestigious institution.
There's a remarkable. In fact, I was talking with somebody on an earlier interview today about this. There are a remarkable number of people with Ivy League degrees who profess to be professional distrusters of the Ivy League, which I don't exactly understand. But they know where their bread is buttered, at least in terms of their honorarium checks and their speaking fees.
What are the three great premises of Idiot America?
Well, I formulated them as I went through the book trying to organize the material. The first great premise is that any theory is valid if it sells books, soaks up ratings, or otherwise moves units. The second one is anything can be true if someone says it loudly enough. Corollary to that is if anyone says it loudly enough on television. And the last one, which sums up the three of them, is fact is that which enough people believe, and truth is determined by how fervently they believe it.
Those are all very sort of sad commentaries on what this country has become. When did we start down this path?
Oh, I think it was. I think, you know, and in the book, I make an important distinction, I hope, between the classic, you know, the United States of America is the greatest country ever devised to be completely out of your mind. We encourage it. We prop it right up in the living room. We put it on the mantelpiece. It's the greatest. The founding documents actually encourage the notion of thinking not only outside the box, but in a sense that the box doesn't even exist. That having been said, we've given up in partly an attempt to be open-minded. We've given up the internal censor, which tells us, you know, just because there are two sides to every argument doesn't mean they're both right. And it's decent to hear both sides, but sometimes one side of the argument is just stupid. And sometimes one side of the argument is so stupid you really shouldn't make public policy based on it. And I think that was accelerated as the media got faster and the information started tumbling in at a rate beyond which it sort of burned out the circuits in our collective mind that allowed us to differentiate this stuff.
I wonder how much of that is the fault of the media, in which, because there are, you know, it's funny to say two sides, often there are 20 sides, but every sort of journalism story has to tell two sides. And sometimes that means giving equal weight to two things that are inherently not equal.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that, you know, while it's good to be fair and it's good to be open-minded, I think it is incumbent on a journalist in his or her job, when they see something that is radically incorrect, not to assume that it's valid simply because a lot of people believe it. There's a sentence that I pulled from the New York Times that I use very early on in Idiot America. Because it struck me as almost the perfect definition of what we're talking about. It was a story in the New York Times about the popularity of intelligent design, which is the most recent sheep's clothing that people have dressed creationism up in to try to get it into science classes. And the reporter wrote, I'm sorry, I have another phone going on here. I apologize. There's a reporter, and she was talking about the controversy about, you know, that's taking place in various school boards and things around the country regarding intelligent design, and she wrote a sentence that says, "They have mounted a politically savvy challenge to evolution as the bedrock of modern biology, propelling a fringe academic movement onto the front pages and putting Darwin's defenders firmly on the defensive." Now, I was struck by the phrase, "a politically savvy challenge to evolution," because to me it makes as much sense as conducting a Gallup poll on gravity. It doesn't matter what percentage of the people believe in what the intelligent design destines to prove. It doesn't make that true, because a lot of people believe it, and a lot of people, you know, manage to get it on the radar of local politicians and full school boards into falling for it. And I was struck by that because that sentence appeared on the front page of the New York Times, which means it had to go through at least three editors, and nobody looked it up and said, you know, a politically savvy challenge to evolution doesn't make any more sense than an agriculturally savvy challenge to Euclidean geometry. The adverb doesn't apply. It doesn't matter if it's politically savvy. It doesn't, because it's politically savvy, doesn't make it true.
You know, the tough thing about something like creationism versus evolution is that they're not tested and sort of measured by the same standards. So you can't, it's not even apples to oranges. They're just two entirely different things. You can't prove or disprove one according to the ways that you prove and disprove the other.
Right, and you cannot, there is no scientific test for God. You can't prove or disprove. You can't falsify, the objective, the scientific method is to propose a hypothesis and then attempt to falsify it, and then attempt to find something that makes what you're trying to prove impossible. And you can't do that with creationism. You can't do it with intelligent design, no matter how much they keep telling you it isn't really religion. It actually is. And there's a chapter in my book with the Judge John Jones, who presided over the Dover intelligent design case, in which the people in Dover, Pennsylvania, wound up in a lawsuit with some of their constituents because they snuck an intelligent, a school board snuck an intelligent design textbook into the public schools. And that town lost a lot of money because they lost in federal court, which means they had to pay costs. And ultimately what Judge Jones decided was that this was essentially religion in sheep's clothing.
Well, and to be fair, there's no scientific test for God. There's no theological formula for science.
Well, in an absolutely global sense, there isn't. I mean, there are certainly people of faith who are very good scientists. I would not deny that, but the two were never meant to be judged by the same standards.
You call the Iraq War America's purest product. Will you talk about that?
Well, I think basically what I talk about in the book is the run up, and I talked with a lot of people who were right and not listened to. And I think it was absolutely a product. It was sold as a complete product of the gut. It was sold based on fear and vengeance and the desire to do something after 9/11 and Afghanistan wasn't big enough. It was manipulated by people who had their own agendas. But the fact is, it was completely based on stuff we felt rather than stuff we knew. We felt that this was something we could go in. It would pay for itself. The oil revenues would pay for itself. It would be in and out quickly. We'd be greeted with candy and flowers. This is stuff we wanted to believe because we felt like that's what we should believe, and we got tangled up in an awful mess.
And you know, it's interesting though that despite all that fervor, that there weren't a lot of really obvious voices out there who were saying the emperor has no clothes on.
Yeah, there were. Well, there were, but nobody listened to them. That was the thing. You couldn't get on television if you felt that way. But I mean, certainly, you know, the McClatchy guys in Washington D.C. were doing tremendous reporting on it. Walter, on the fact that there was no there in the evidence. The Walter Pincus from the Washington Post, the foreign press, the BBC, and the French press especially. There were other world leaders who were getting up and howling. Hans Blix was saying it. Mohammed El-Baradei at the UN was saying it. There were people within the intelligence community talking about how it's not going to be as easy as you think it is, and you know the evidence we have here. And people realized that the famous Niger letter was a forgery. There were people who knew that it was a forgery. It's just that nobody listened to them because nobody wanted to hear what they had to say.
Why didn't anybody listen, do you think?
Oh, I think that I think the people who wanted the war didn't listen because they didn't want to listen and they thought things were going their own way. I mean, they had their own reasons for ignoring evidence, and that was because they wanted what they wanted. The rest of us, I think, again, we were deluged by, you know, we were, we and I, in this I include the elite political media, we were deluged by an incredible surge of propaganda, by an incredible, you know, I think that, you know, there is no more tragic episode in this whole thing than Colin Powell going before the UN and presenting a case that he already knew, at least in part, was fictitious.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Charles P. Pierce. His new book is called Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. I want to talk a little bit more about this idea that news tends to exploit our deepest fears, at least in the 21st century. Will you talk about what you've seen and what you've read?
Well, I think news, which is now, you know, a term encompassing, you know, a vast range beyond which it never, you know, of things it never included in itself before. I think there's a great tendency to give people what they want rather than what they need. And I think when you're feeding appetites rather than feeding intellect, you're going to go for the quick and easy, which is to tell people what to be afraid of, tell people how to keep themselves safe, tell people to trust X, Y, or Z depending on what your particular story is about. And not to tell them, hey, look, you know, a lot of what you know about your world is wrong. That doesn't move needs. As I said in the first great premise, that does not move units. That does not push the ratings needle.
Well, I mean, if people, to the extent that people want to be told things, and I guess they also want to be entertained.
Yeah, I think so, and I think we've completely misapprehended that. I mean, I do think we are. I think Neil Postman's right about a lot of things. We really have amused ourselves almost to death here. We have the ability to turn everything into some sort of entertainment. I'm in my earlier days was a sports writer and still write a lot of sports. We do have a tendency to turn everything into one competition or another, rather than seeing the actual facts for what they are. And if our side is winning, then we're happy. And if the other side is winning, then we're sad. But we're not moving the policy needle, and we're not getting anything done. I mean, I think you're seeing that right now with the oil spill. I mean, the Gulf of Mexico is turning into a Jiffy Lube right now. And all I hear on my television is who's up and who's down and who's to blame.
You know, it's funny when you talk about everything's a great competition. It's a competition for media ratings. Certainly in politics, a lot of the reporting that you hear on politics is about poll numbers and who's doing what and what the strategy. It's so interesting that so much of the analysis really has to do with political strategy as opposed to policy and platforms.
Well, it's easier. It's always easier to cover the horse race than it is to cover the actual policies. I think one of the great tragedies in elite political journalism is that there is a White House press corps at all. If you want to cover the executive branch, cover the executive branch, but don't do it from the White House press room. You're not going to learn anything there. Go out in the agencies. Go out and talk to, you know, assistant secretaries of HEW or field workers in the Interior Department and find out what's really going on in the country. Don't sit up there, you know, like, you know, performing monkeys twice a day for the press secretary to jerk you around. That doesn't solve anything.
But if you're not, in many cases, if you're not part of the press corps, there are other things that you miss out on.
Maybe. To be honest with you, I don't know what you would miss out not being in the White House press room. I really don't. I mean, I keep waiting for someone to explain that to me. What are you going to miss? The latest thing the president wants you to cover. Okay, fine.
Well, yeah, it's targeted leaks is what you miss.
Yeah.
My guest is Charles P. Pierce. His new book is called Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You are welcome to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from summer youth programs at SMU and Plano. You can help kids create, design, and think their way to an unforgettable summer. Online at smu.edu/summerfun.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Charles P. Pierce. His new book is called Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. The book is newly out in trademark with a brand new afterword. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. We should back up here for a second, Charlie, and remind people that you are not categorically opposed to the presence of cranks in our society. You just don't want them on TV.
No, that's a little bit simple. Yeah, I am absolutely in favor of the traditional American crank, the wild idea who stands out there proudly alone. I think the problem with American cranks is that we've brought them into the mainstream now, and not only have we infected the mainstream with crazy ideas, we've ruined the idea of a crank. I mean, a crank who joins the mainstream. All our cranks now have, you know, have radio programs and book deals and suits in federal court. That devalues the crank to our society, who's supposed to stand proudly outside it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go first on the phones to Kristen in Dallas. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. Mostly, I have just a comment. The more I'm listening to the guest today, the more I'm wondering if he isn't an uncredited screenwriter for a movie called Idiocracy. Every time I've watched this movie, the thing my husband and I end up talking about is how not outrageous most of the societal conclusions are within the movie. And I just, everything he's talking about, it just is ringing so familiar from that and then the discussions that came after this movie. So bravo on the book, but I was just wondering if he happens to know about this, kind of a silly movie, but if he knew about this movie and knows, you know, understands what I'm talking about here.
I'm aware of the movie. I didn't have a hand in writing it, as you can probably tell if I showed you my bank account. this is there are a number of treatments of this, from Al Gore and Susan Jacoby, who are deeply serious, to that movie, to Green Day, to me, I guess.
You took a road trip to Hebron, Kentucky. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I went. Well, I actually made two of them. I went to visit, and this is the genesis of this project, which was a magazine story I wrote in Esquire in the fall of 2005 called Greetings from Idiot America. I read a story in the New York Times about the construction of the Creation Museum in Hebron, Kentucky, and one of the features of the Creation Museum, because they believe that the humans and dinosaurs coexisted, was they had scale model dinosaurs with saddles on them. And I sent a three-word pitch to my editor, Mark Warren, a good Texas boy, by the way, from Corpus Christi at Esquire. It was a three-word pitch. It said, "Dinosaurs with saddles?" And I went down there when they were building it. I joined up so I could get the VIP tour while they were building it. And then I went back while I was researching the book that came from the magazine article, and they've actually finished it. And it is really quite something. And I urge everybody in America to go see it, because it is an incredible simulacrum of an actual museum designed to promulgate absolute nonsense.
What did you have a chance to talk to the people who were on the tour with you?
A little bit. A lot of these folks that were on the VIP tour with me. I went myself the second time, just as paid the admission and just kind of wandered in. So when I was on the VIP tour, there were a lot of folks from all around the Midwest, although there were a couple of Pennsylvania and North Carolina license plates in the parking lot. Obviously all of them very fundamental in their Protestant Christianity. Great number of homeschoolers, including groups of homeschoolers on school buses. I wasn't aware homeschoolers had school buses, but I guess that's the way it goes. And they were all taking legitimate field trips or were waiting, because the time I went with them was the time they were still building it, waiting to take field trips to the museum once it was finished.
Did you ask them about their beliefs, or were you sort of undercover as...
I was just sort of going along with it. I mean, I was fairly familiar with most of the... I didn't really have a question. You know, I couldn't walk up to them after a guy says that there were no carnivorous dinosaurs until Adam and Eve were cast out of Eden. I mean, if someone actually believes that, I don't know what the first question to that person is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Sam in Dallas. Hi, Sam.
Yeah. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Okay. Just adding to what you guys are discussing about, very profound, very huge topic, very small comment I would like to make. Like, for example, how would I see the idiocracy going on around? People talk about being pro-life. So suppose, let's take that big topic, and I'll simply make a small comment on that. What does pro-life mean? What they're saying is sacrifice this life for the afterlife, for the heaven. And this is how pro-life as it gets. And whereas my experience of life, and perhaps yours too, you can endorse, that life is here now. I cannot plan to be happy tomorrow. Same way death will happen right then and there, right now. I cannot plan to die tomorrow or later. You know?
Well, I think that may sort of take us a little afield of where we are now, but do you want to comment, Charlie?
I have to admit I fell out of the car on the last turn there. I don't know exactly what we're talking about, Sam.
All right, well, let's move on. We will go this time to Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I want to defend cranks. cranks are idealistic. They stand for something, and maybe they're a little nutty and off the rocker, but usually they're consistent. What we get in the media are sophists and whores, quite frankly. They're given their paid speeches. Nowhere in the legislative process, nowhere in the media, is there an inquiry into what's the best, most efficient, and eloquent legislation or way to address problems. We lie. The Hans Blix, a devastating rebuttal to Colin Powell's testimony. I heard it on NPR. I think I'm the only one in America because it got no coverage.
I heard it on the BBC.
it was devastating. And yet, not a word. You know, this economic collapse, why not just put simple professional rules on them, fiduciary duty, where they have to look after their principals first? They go, no, we're just vendors. We don't have any special knowledge. And that's a simple bulk set of rules and regulations which would go on to that market without a heavy kind of regulation, which I think people rightly fear. But so there are ways around these things. The tax on income, on insurance policies, they could index that inflation if they wanted to hit a certain deal. They want a hard cap, so it's going to grow.
So is the idea, do you think, Charlie, that we just are too lazy to follow through and pay attention to all the facts involved?
I think we have lost profoundly the habits of self-government, and one of them is to be informed as to the issues that pertain to the general political commonwealth. Yeah, I think as a self-governing commonwealth, we are really bad right now.
You write that the founders looked at self-government almost like a science.
Well, they looked at government as a science. They looked at government as a science, but they also looked at it as a participatory sport. And the way they would, especially Madison, who's my sort of one of the heroic threads through my book, is I hope a decent appreciation for James Madison, who was always the guy under the hood tinkering. And believe that everybody had that right and everybody had that obligation. We don't seem to believe it as an obligation anymore. And that's generally startling.
Is it a matter of us having been, you know, fed all of this, or have we simply capitulated our responsibility to pay attention?
I think we've done the latter because the former was so effective. I think that the powers of persuasion, the powers of the persuasion industry in this country, applied in so many different areas, have gone beyond our abilities to keep up and to keep, an intellectual discernment going. And I think that's been a real shame.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time it's Brian in Fort Worth. Hi, Brian.
Yes, hi. I agree with the author, and but actually I don't think this is a new phenomenon. I think it's always been this way, whether it's crank TV people or creation museums or religion or Dick Cheney. Appealing to people's emotions to get them to have certain beliefs. You know, they've done functional MRI scans on people in studies like this, and that part of the brain that lights up is right next and on top of the pleasure center. Now, when someone just deals with pure facts and reason, it's nowhere near the emotion system. So I would submit that it's always been this way, and most likely, unfortunately, always will be, that a good majority of people, quote, think with emotion rather than reason. Any comments on that?
Well, no, I think you're right, and I think that, certainly there are, when Madison talks about factions in the Federalist Papers, that's exactly what he's talking about. I do think, though, that the current acceleration of our culture the acceleration of the media in our culture right now has brought that problem to a pitch that may well be, it may well be uncontrollable. The momentum behind it may well be uncontrollable at this point.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Maybe you can talk for a minute, Charlie, about the idea that we don't trust government, and a lot of people who tell us not to trust government are working in the government.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, actually. We've lost track of the fact that the government is us. You know, that's who it is. That's what we've been handed in this system. And when you talk about the government as though it's an alien entity, yeah, people feel, you know, people feel disengaged and people feel abandoned and people feel, you know, as though government is at a remove from them. But it really is. It really does have to be us. If it's not, and I think that the politicians who tell us not to trust politics and the people in government who tell us not to trust government are the one of, if they're not the preeminent charlatans of the age, they're very close.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Ronnie in Fort Worth. Hey, Ronnie.
Hey, good afternoon. The very first time I voted in a presidential election was in 1980 under Ronald Reagan. I joined the military in 1984, and I always considered myself to be a true patriot, a lover of the United States of America, and I always bought what the government was telling me. It just seemed like I always thought to myself, they wouldn't lie to us, they wouldn't steal from us, they're our elected officials. This is the United States of America, the best country in the world. Surely we're better than the countries you hear about overseas that are corrupt and these governments that do all these terrible things. And I always wondered, I guess my question is, what am I like everybody else in that when I'm young and immature, I guess? I just buy what's put in front of me, and then whenever I get older and I start questioning things and looking at things, I can find the lies and in the cracks. That's really, I guess, all I have to say.
What do you think, Charlie?
Well, I think it's important to question, and I think we do a pretty bad job in our education system teaching kids to question. I think we do a rotten job in our education teaching kids what used to be called civics and what their responsibilities are to themselves and to the political entity in which they, intend to spend their lives. So I agree with Ronnie that, this kind of thing, can dawn on people late. And if they're not careful, it can be brought to them by people who don't have their best interests at heart.
We have an email here from Sammy who writes, you say that journalists must provide both sides of the story. I agree, but I have to bring up Fox News. They provide only their view of the story, which really disturbs me.
Yeah, I think that they are a classic example of all three great premises, but especially, the second one, which is anything can be true if someone says it loudly enough on television. And they are essentially, pitching to their team. They're not trying to persuade anybody. They're just trying to give the people who already believe in what they're selling, a product to buy.
But despite the fair and balanced tagline, at least people who tune to Fox News, they know that's why they're going there. Are you more bothered by so-called mainstream media that say we're right down the line and then still fail to really analyze to the extent that is probably appropriate?
I think I do. I mean, I think I am bothered more by the latter than the former. I do agree that there's a caveat emptor, element to Fox, especially now. I mean, anybody who goes to Fox News now expecting anything except conservative, except the straight rightist line on almost anything is has no excuse for themselves at this point. But I do think that what the so-called mainstream media or the so-called elite political media really has paralyzed itself in terms of what it perceives to be fair, what it perceives to be fair, and what it perceives to be balanced.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time to Earl in McKinney. Hi, Earl.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I'd like to ask your guest what he thinks about the actual people that deliver the news. I know there's a specific corporate image that these people must fulfill. I know those are a number of local people have actually lost their jobs because they, quote, didn't fit the corporate image, who are actually good people. But, I mean, you don't see people like old Walter Cronkite and stuff delivering the news. They have to be pert and pretty and handsome and whatever. I'm just curious to what your guest thinks about that.
Yeah, I think that the qualifications for being a good local TV anchor person, I think journalism is, pretty way down. You know, reporting is pretty far down the list at this point. There was an interesting thing. There's a chapter in the book. I went to the, and this is nothing to do with local news, but it has to do with talk radio. I went to the what's called the New Media Conference, but essentially it was a trade show for talk radio hosts in New York as part of the research for the book. And it was a classic trade show. There were large plenary sessions and then breakout sessions where you could all go and listen to speakers talk about, you know, the various aspects of your industry. And the remarkable thing to me about it, in all the breakout sessions over 3 days of this convention, there wasn't a single breakout session on any issue that these people would be talking about. It was all about doing a better talk show. It was all about increasing your audience and driving your callers and you know, a whole bunch of, you know, talk radio jargon that's you know, long since fallen out of my head. But I thought to myself, these guys have a huge audience, you know, or certainly a great percentage of the radio audience in their local, you know, because a lot of these guys were like the local evening drive guy. And I thought, nobody's here, you know, nobody's going to a breakout session about climate change or a breakout session about Afghanistan or a breakout session about, you know, the possibility that the economic bubble will burst. And I thought, and then after, by the end of the weekend, I thought, these guys don't have to go to that. They already know what they think about those things.
What has happened in this country that we're all required to have an opinion on everything, including that about which we know very little?
Well, I think we've rewarded people for being inexpert in a lot of areas. You know, there's no reason why, for example, Sean Hannity's opinion on stem cell research should count any more than that of the guy that fixes my car. They're both equally expert at the complicated science of engineering and embryos. However, one of them is wildly successful at pitching his ideas to a marketplace. So he is considered to be somewhat expert, even though he's, frankly, just an NYU dropout with a microphone.
Charles P. Pierce is my guest. His new book is called Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. The book has just been re-released in Trademack, and there's a new afterword to it. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from summer youth programs at SMU and Plano. You can help kids create, design, and think their way to an unforgettable summer. Online at smu.edu/summerfun.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Charles P. Pierce. His new book is called Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. A lot of what we've talked here, Charlie, you've sort of implicitly gone after conservatives. Are there idiot liberals?
I'm sure there are, but they don't seem to be driving the train with quite the influence that the three great premises are driving modern conservatism in the Republican Party. As somebody said to me, I was in Mississippi over the weekend, and in one of the enclaves of liberalism, even in Mississippi, somebody said, you know, for whatever it was in the 1970s and 60s and 70s, liberals didn't elect Abby Hoffman to Congress.
1-800-933.
I mean, it was remarkable to me. One of the most remarkable moments of the 2008 presidential campaign, and it was. It's been passed over because of the event that became Barack Obama, but there was a Republican debate in New Hampshire in which there were all 10 candidates were there. And somebody asked them, first of all, the idea that this question was even asked in a presidential debate gives you an indication of how far from the pack the Republican Party has strayed. They were asked if they believed in if how many of them didn't believe in evolution. Three of the 10 candidates put up their hands. One-third of the Republican Party presidential field in 2008 admitted that its view of the physical sciences stopped in the 1850s. That, to me, was astonishing.
I want to know if you think they really believe that, or if they think that that's what voters want them to believe.
At this point, it doesn't matter. If either they believe it, which is tragic, or they're saying it because enough people in their party to make a difference believe it, which is tragic still, which is more tragic still.
So what is there to gain from this?
To gain from what?
From the whole idea of eschewing science and of, you know, going with the gut, as you say.
Well, I mean there are people whose careers will indicate that there's tangible political and economic. I mean, there's certainly, you can make a pretty good living as a talk show host, as a radio talk show host on AM radio, if you say the right things, no matter how crazy. You can make a pretty good living as a pundit on TV, no matter how. I mean, there are pundits on TV. Gordon Liddy is, I'm sorry, a crazy person. Okay, he's had a very good second career once he got out of prison, being a crazy person on the radio. There's political advantage in certain parts of the country to be gained from it. I don't have to tell anybody from Texas about that. You know, I saw Rick Perry, who's been talking about secession, which, as my friend Roy Blunt Jr. says, was a bad idea at the time and looks even worse in retrospect. He was on the cover of Time magazine a couple weeks ago. So there are things to be gained from it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Mauricio in Dallas. Hi, Mauricio.
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity. I wanted to ask Charles if he believes that the country is forced into two separate sides, and it's very difficult to have a deeper, more relevant discussion if everybody has a tagline, everybody has a short elevator pitch, and they quickly either go into agreement or disagreement with the other side, when we should have more elevated discussions about positions and ideas in order to go forward with progress. Along with that, we see very little international news other than tragic events and the two wars, Afghanistan and Iraq. So we are isolated from the world except for the wars.
What do you think, Charlie?
I think he's right, especially about the latter part. I remember when, in the 80s, when, overseas coverage on the networks was cut way, way back, and people would say, well, what do we need, five people in Moscow for? Well, you might need five people in Moscow because you need one person to keep eye on a place like Afghanistan, okay, which somehow became relevant again in September of 2001. I do agree with him that I don't know that we're forced into, a kind of, football game of ideas in our national dialogue, or whether or not we just move into that particular frame because it's easier than thinking.
So I have to wonder if the question is, should it be shame on us for allowing this to exist, particularly when you look at the media and politics? These are two fields in which we, as either consumers or voters, are driving the bus.
You're absolutely correct. And as I say in the book, Idiot America is an act of will. Idiot America is an act of collective, is the sum of collective actions we take as a society. We don't have to be uninformed. We don't have to have politics like this. We don't have to have media like this. We are empowered by the system we were handed to have the government and have the politics and have the culture that that we create for ourselves. And if one's created that we don't like, then that's on us. It's not on the people who are succeeding within it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Yankoy in Dallas. Hi, Yankoy.
Hi, yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I got a few thoughts here.
Just make it real quick because we've got lots of people on the line. Just pick one
for
us.
Yes, I'm concerned about the civics and geography education of the average American. I'm an immigrant, and I'm kind of tired every time having to tell people where I'm from, and then when I tell them where I'm from, and I see the part of the areas I'm from, and then they ask me, where is that? And for example, let me just give another example. For example, many people just think Latinos are Mexicans, and Africans are all from the same country. And apart from that, even basic knowledge of basic American geography and education, things that you would expect a 12th grader to know about, the average American still fall behind a lot. Those are things that I knew before even coming to this country.
Yeah, why do you think, Charlie, that we don't really understand the world as well as people in other parts of the world?
I think a lot of it is hubris. I think a lot of it is insecurity. I think a lot of it is fear that we aren't the driving force in the world that we like to pretend we are. I think a lot of it is that we don't teach geography real well. I think a lot of it is that our media has pulled in its, you know, really pulled in its coverage of the rest of the world. I was taught in, I always get a big kick about people who want to go back to the way we used to teach history. The way I was taught world history was, and I will grant you this was in Catholic school, so there was, sort of overemphasis on the actions of the papacy. But the history I learned coming up was sort of watered down Anglo-centric. It wasn't even Eurocentric, it was Anglo-centric. So that when, the Balkans erupted, for example, in the 80s and 90s, the history of that whole conflict was sadly news to me.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Lauren in Plano. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. I wanted to tell the author that I believe, thank you for giving us this brutal reality. I think sometimes we need to face things like that, and especially with the media. And if you would talk a little bit about agenda setting in the media, because that's something that's huge, having a preset notion of what we're supposed to see on the TV. And I speak three languages and I look at websites and I get my news for myself. But those people who just sit in front of their TV are being fed this, basically an RSS feed, if you will, of the same rote information.
Yeah, I don't know that there's as much political agenda set. I mean, leaving Fox aside, I don't know that there's, and the opinion shows on other, on MSNBC and so forth, I don't know if there's so much agenda setting in the news as there is political agenda setting in the news as there is corporate agenda setting, as there is the kind of presiding notion that the audience needs to be pandered to rather than informed. I think when you talk about agenda setting in the media, I think that's what you're talking about more than any specific political agenda, regardless of what, various propagandists may say.
What kinds of discussions are taking place in terms of who's going to be hired to make these decisions? Is it people who have more of an entertainment background now than a journalistic background?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. I think that you're now seeing people who came up through the infotainment, as they call it, industry, now are in the positions of doing the hiring. And I think that I don't see that getting any better, to be perfectly honest with you.
1-800-933-5372, our number. Next up is Christopher in Irving. Hello, Christopher.
Hi, I had a question for the author as well. I just wanted to get his thoughts on how these conservative talk shows become so popular and how they're able to mold and craft their viewers' opinions.
Well, I think that, I mean, when you say those conservative talk shows, you're talking about a vast audience. I think in a lot of cases, it's because the people running them are very, very good at their jobs. Say what you will about Rush Limbaugh, he is a brilliant broadcaster. He knows the potential and the dynamics of being a radio host. So I think number one, we admit that a lot of them are really good at their jobs. Number two, there's a consistent message. Number three, at this point, they are established figures in the world of ideas, whether we want them to be or not. I think their influence is sadly, too great. But at this point, at this point, I think that conservatives saw the future when music moved to FM and when the Fairness Doctrine came under attack right at the beginning of the Reagan administration. They saw what could happen, and they jumped on it. And frankly, liberals were left at the gate and never did catch up. Now, I think that you can say the same thing about the left and the blogosphere and the Internet. I think they stole a march on conservatives, and conservatives have never caught up there. And I think that's been the great balancing of the conservative monopoly on local and national talk radio has been the liberal web. And I think but the problem was it took there's a gap of about 8 or 9 years in there when conservative talk radio had the field to itself.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Bernie in Frisco. Hello, Bernie.
Hi. I will be teaching a course on government and the Constitution and where we are now at Collin College to a group of seniors starting June 1st. I'm going to tell them about Mr. Pierce's book. I'm familiar with his earlier works, some of them. And I just hold out a ray of hope that Mark Potok of the Southern Law Poverty Center finally was allowed to say on television that Ronald Reagan was responsible for a great deal of the turmoil, including right up to and including the teabaggers. When Ronald Reagan told people not to trust government, to be afraid of government, he tried to and did destroy Lincoln's concept of government of, by, and for the people. I appreciate you very much, Mr. Pierce.
Thank you. Good luck with your course, sir.
Where do you think we're headed?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, that's the one question I always get asked when I do appearances connected with this book, and the people ask me what's the solution and where are we headed. I really don't know. I thought for a while, and this is the part of the afterword in the paperback edition, if I can just plug the paperback edition.
Absolutely.
You know, as I told my editor at Random House, sooner or later I have to sit down and write this thing. I had a very interesting, I was in Oxford, Mississippi this weekend at the Great Square Books, and they had the paperback on the front table there, and I was autographing it. And a gentleman from Ireland, from Cork City, who's touring the United States, came up and saw me signing and said, "Oh, you're the author, so I'll buy one." And he picked it up and he looked at it and said, "Why is it so thin?" And I said, "Because I had to write it sooner or later." I thought that given the craziness that surrounded the opposition to Barack Obama, the fact that he got elected as decisively as he did, I thought that meant maybe we were starting to clear away some of this stuff, because it really did require you to get beyond a lot of really unpleasant old baggage to vote for him. As soon as he got elected, what I saw re-erupt was old-fashioned American nut populism right out of Father Coughlin. A lot of it, unfortunately, was racially motivated. I mean, I don't think, you know, when you see a 30-year-old white woman in Arkansas weeping 3 months into the administration that she wants her country back, I don't think you need the Enigma machine to decode that. But that having been said, a lot of it was just old. I mean, the rise of Glenn Beck is old-fashioned Birchite, Father Coughlin, nut American populism. You know, hidden hands of the gnomes of Zurich and the Illuminati and all these people. Suddenly we're mustered into opposition to Barack Obama. So the short answer to your question is, if that's the reaction to the election of a fairly moderate, you know, Democrat, I don't know where we're headed. But we're all along for the ride. And the one thing we can't do, we can believe in nonsense, Kate. We can believe in nonsense. We can act on nonsense. But in this country, we cannot walk away from the consequences of believing and acting on nonsense. And if we believe we can do that, then we're going to severely damage ourselves as a nation.
Do we need more extreme forces somehow? Do you want extreme people on the left to battle extreme people on the right? Or do you want us to get somewhere to truth in the center?
I don't know. The truth is always in the center, and I think we should abandon that as a notion, because that, I think, has caused us to be very mushy in our thinking. Truth is sometimes in the center. Truth is sometimes on the right. Truth is sometimes on the left. But truth, and what we have to do is get back to intellect and get away from the gut. We cannot assume that because we feel something and our neighbors feel something and maybe a majority of our citizens feel something, it is necessarily true.
Charles P. Pierce's new book is called Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. It's just been released in tradeback with a new afterword. Charlie, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you much for having me. I appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.